This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Space, the final frontier.
These are the voyages of the Starship Enterprise. Its continuing mission to explore strange new worlds. To boldly go where no one has gone before.
Engage. Enterprise.
This is Captain Jean-Luc Picard.
Captain Catherine Janeway.
Captain Sisko.
This is Captain Jonathan Archer.
Red alert.
Photon torpedoes, fire.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Engage.
Make it so.
With your host, Jordan Hoffman.
That, sir, is illogical.
And make sure history never forgets.
This is Engage.
Failing frequencies open, sir.
And welcome back, everybody. Welcome back. We made it, Brian. We made it. It's mid-season.
It is.
How does it feel to be mid-season?
It feels great. The first thing I thought was like that's how you leave a cliffhanger.
That's how you leave a cliffhanger. Yeah, really, really good stuff. We just watched episode 9, 109, as we like to call it in the biz, an episode which I thought was really edge of your seat stuff. I didn't know what was going to happen. I was literally unsure. You know, they killed off, so many key characters already on the show. I didn't know who was going to live or die, who was going to go into a spore coma, what was going to explode. So I was really on the edge of my seat, and I really dug it. So it's time to dig in our heels and do a nice recap of this, our last recap for a couple of weeks, almost a month and a half until season 1.5 begins.
Which is January 7th.
January 7th, which, Brian, I'm going to be on the Star Trek cruise with Jonathan Frakes, who was the director of episode 110. So I don't know how the heck that's going to work. But you know what? We have a long time to figure out the specifics of that. Brian, this episode had the name Into the Forest I Go.
Yes.
And I think it's time I want to bring something up. You know how I know the names of these episodes?
How is that?
I look them up on Wikipedia. Nowhere in the show does it actually have the name printed, unlike Star Trek's of the past. You know, on TNG, you would have the cold open, then you would have the theme and the cool graphics, and then you would go away and get a commercial, and then you would come back, and it would say, you know, Best of Both Worlds, Part 1. With this, you don't know until you look on Wikipedia the next day. Is that right?
I wonder if it's written in the credits anywhere, like the closing credits, maybe.
Who can wait until the closing credits? True. I'm scooping my brains off the carpet because the show's been so good. So, anyway, the new episode is called "Into the Forest I Go," which is something that Stamets mumbles to Dr. Hugh Culber in his Mycium delirium when he's jumping like a lunatic. So, which I don't know if it means how to interpret it, but anyway, that's the episode's name, and that's my commentary on the titles on this one. But there's a lot going on. Brian, first of all, I think it's time to say the following thing. A global note about Star Trek Discovery and what my number one takeaway is so far. Are you ready for this?
Right, I'm ready.
Here it comes. Jason Isaacs is one of the greatest actors working today.
Yes, I completely agree.
I have fired a photon torpedo at Hollywood. It's not that Jason Isaacs has been lingering in, he's not been unemployed his whole career. He is not a young man. He is a handsome man. Don't get me wrong. But he is in, according to Wikipedia, which I've now revealed to be the backbone of this podcast, is where I get all of my information. Jason Isaacs is a man 54 years of age. He is in the shank of his career. And he has been working nonstop for decades in both theater and film and television. For example, in the early 1990s, he played the role of Lewis in the British premiere of both parts of Angels in America, which is a big deal if you're a theater guy. He's been probably, you know, most famous and the thing that, you know, is going to put his kids through school and bought him a nice house was he was, of course, in most, if not all, of the Harry Potter films.
Yes.
As Draco Malfoy's father, Lucius. And although he was not the star, he was a pivotal guy who would show up. But you look back, the dude was in the movie Dragonheart in 1996. He was in Event Horizon.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
Yeah, and that movie rules. Event Horizon was directed by a fellow by the name of Paul W.S. Anderson. Not Paul Thomas Anderson, Paul W.S. Anderson. And he's been in a lot of Paul W.S. Anderson's films. Now, a lot of those movies are terrible, but he's kind of Paul W.S. Anderson's, you know, guy. Like, he shows up in a lot of stuff. He was in Black Hawk Down. He was in the movie. He was one of the voice. He does a lot of voice acting, too. He was Sinestro in one of the DC animated films.
Oh, that's right.
He was Lex Luthor in something else. And he was Admiral Zhao.
He was also Ra's al Ghul in one of the Batman animated movies, Under the Red Hood.
This guy is all over the place. And he was Admiral Zhao in Avatar: The Last Airbender.
Oh.
Which is a great show. I love that show. And in a lot of other stuff. So I guess what I'm saying is, it's been, you know, sometimes there are actors who show up and they just kind of, you don't, and maybe it's my fault, but like they just kind of recede into the fabric of the show or the movie, and you don't really realize how pivotal they are. And it takes, now you watch the OA, right?
Yes, and actually his performance in that is very comparable to this. He's although he's more of a villainous character, it's very like nuanced and kind of gray, and you kind of like, you don't really know where to think of it in terms of good or bad, I guess.
Yeah, I gotta watch the OA. I haven't watched the OA.
It isn't for everybody, like, but something about it grabbed me, and I very much enjoyed it. And I have a few friends that I got to watch it, and you know they enjoyed it too. So we had some discussions about it.
Yeah, all right. I'm gonna do that one because I like the woman who wrote it, Britt Marling.
Yes.
She made a great science fiction movie called Sound of My Voice, which I really really like. So, Jason Isaacs, and I think I mentioned this two episodes ago. It kind of has like a John Hamm thing for me, you know, like he has a real presence, and you like him and you hate him simultaneously.
Yes.
He can be a little bit funny. But in this episode, he really, you know, he blasts it open. He is the hero. He stands up to the Admiral, the Vulcan who,
whose name
Admiral
I can't remember.
Terrell, I think it is. Which is funny because there's a Captain Terrell in Star Trek, Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan, but it's a different Terrell because that Terrell was a human and not a Vulcan. He stands up to him and he saves the Povins. He says, "I'm not running away from a fight." And then he seems like he's, you know, altruistic, but then you really don't know. And then the moment when he finds out Admiral Cornwell has been saved, he's kind of like, "Oh, great," you know. So there's a lot going on, and I just can't. I think he has been the surprise for me because I had my nothing against the other actors. They're all great. Anthony Rapp, Sonequa Martin-Green, they're all terrific. But when the show's marketing was gearing up, it was all about Michael Burnham and Sonequa. And she's wonderful, but she's been, and this is not a criticism, this is just an observation, it's been kind of like she hasn't evolved past episode 3. She's been that I am low, and everything's been taken away from me, and it's been just sort of like she's been on an incline. So I guess she has evolved, but she has not changed. She's been like, I'm blanked out, I'm nothing, and I'm just going to be virtuous and true and eventually rise back into something. And along the way, she's done more missions. She started to have feelings with Ash Tyler, but we're kind of with her, so it's not like we're learning stuff about her. You know, does that make any sense?
Yeah, yes. It seems like a very well-plotted course with Burnham, but I feel like with Lorca, it's like ups and downs all over the place, and we just don't know where he's coming from or where he's going.
Exactly.
And I find him to be the most interesting character in the show by far.
I know. I kind of do too, and it's pretty neat. And the one thing particular, And, you know, let's just assume that everybody listening to this now has watched the episode. There was the moment when he shows Stamets the project he's been working on, which is that each of these spore jumps, every time they ride the mycelium network of highways or whatever it is, it graphs out on some MacGuffin display portals to various parallel universes. It's a little vague, but I'll buy it. And he shows it to Stamets, and Stamets says, and I even wrote the line down because I thought it was kind of the way he said it was nice.
I didn't know you cared.
Captain, I didn't know you cared. And Stamets is and what he's trying to do is convince Stamets to put his life at risk,
yes,
to save to stop the war and go into a spore drive hell. And Stamets is really touched by Lorca's desire for exploration, for learning, for science, and also to know what Stamets wants out of life. He knows that Stamets is the explorer, and Stamets buys it. Stamets is like, my God, Lorca, whom I've known as a battle-weary warrior captain, is actually altruistic and good. And when I was watching it, I was with Stamets. I'm like, wow, Lorca is a good guy. Lorca is the shit. I was watching this with my wife, Brian.
Yeah.
And she had the exact opposite take, well, which means she's probably right. Because she said, ooh, that guy is a snake. He knows just what buttons to push.
Yeah, I had that same impression. And what really gave it away for me is that he kind of, I think this happens a few minutes later, but he's kind of willing to risk Stamets' life, but the second they decide that the only possible way to get around this battle is to send an away mission, and he just doesn't want to risk Burnham, I found that very, very interesting. And I'm like, you know what? He's got this all. He's got everybody figured out, and he knows how to get what he wants. So,
wait. Let's back that up for a second.
Sure.
You're because I didn't know what to make of the fact that he didn't want to send Burnham. I just thought he didn't trust her, or he just thought she wasn't good enough. He didn't want to risk Burnham.
Correct. Well, I mean, one of the preview beforehand, they show that when they go to, I guess they're going to save Sarek. He tells Tyler, make sure you bring her back alive or don't come back. He's very protective of her. So, I still haven't quite figured out why. I mean,
well, you actually suggested this a few episodes back. You think he wants to keep her around in case things go south so he can throw her under the bus.
That's right. I did say that.
She is his eternal get out of jail free card.
That is true. That could be
But you know what? I reject this. I reject my wife and I reject you. I think you're being too negative, and I think you need to take a cue from Stamets and maybe give Lorca the benefit of the doubt. Or is that being really, really naive?
Again, maybe my guess from a few episodes ago is a little on the extreme side, but still, it's... You have Stamets, who is the only person that can operate this spore drive. They don't know how to replicate it.
Yeah.
And he's willing to risk his life for this, but he won't risk Burnham's life. And he's shown that several times. So I'm very curious.
You're 100% right, and that does a flag on the play. That requires further review. I will give you that. However, I do think, though, and this is great in the story, he's willing to risk Stamets' life because he's all in. He puts a line in the sand. He says, "Now we will end the Klingon War. We're going to save the Pavans," which is nice. You know, he went, and that was, you know, Burnham wants that. Tyler wants that. Saru certainly wants that. Save the Pavans. Why is Saru back on the bridge when he practically committed mutiny 15 minutes ago?
Well, they did give you that little nod. Like, let me talk to them. I understand their peace loving ways.
Yeah. All right. I'll let that slide. But he's going to save the Pavans.
Hold on here. Let's go back one more second.
Yeah.
I even think that his desire to save the Pavans is also part of manipulation of the entire crew, really. He's trying to get them on his side. It's like, hey, we need to save these people. He probably more so just wants to fight the Klingons and end the war, but he doesn't necessarily care.
Maybe. I mean... He is an ends justifies the means guy, but, you know, I think let's put it this way. If he has the option of fighting the Klingons sort of in open space versus saving the Klingons and also rescuing a planet of innocent life forms, why wouldn't he want to rescue the innocent
life forms? I feel like there have been situations in previous episodes where he has... I guess this was when it was involving Admiral Cornwell, where they wouldn't go to the rescue mission.
Right.
I guess
right.
He was saving his own skin in that regard, but...
And I have a theory about Cornwall for the very last scene of the movie, of the show. But
okay.
I'm going to give him the benefit. I'm like Lorca's defense attorney. I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt on that one. So he acts like a true Kirk era captain. We put the stand here. We're going to save the Povins. We're going to figure out how to bust through their rudimentary cloaking device through a very wacky means of jumping all over the place like a crazy person, and he's going to risk Stamets. Now, this is something that's different, though. I don't think I've ever seen a Star Trek captain or that would risk his crew member's life so obviously. Like, there have been captains that have stood aside when somebody else rose from the ranks and said, "No, let me. I will ride into danger." You know, I've seen Spock do that 100 times, and Kirk like allows it. And you know, there are other examples of that. But in this case, he doesn't order Stamets to go into what could very well be suicide, but he comes pretty close. You know, he kind of twists his arm into doing it.
Yeah, and he definitely encourages him. And I think
that's something you see. Yeah, it's very new. You see that in other war movies. Like, you see that in K-19, The Widowmaker, for those who ever saw that, where he orders, like, there's only one dude who can go and fix the whatever it is that's underwater, and he knows the guy's going to drown, but he sends him anyhow and makes him go. And you see that in Lee Marvin in The Big Red One, when they're on Normandy Beach and they've got to lay they've got to run across a part of the beach, and you know, everybody he calls to do it, he goes, Thompson, get up here, run over there, and Thompson gets killed, and he goes, you McMurray, run over there, and he's just ordering people to their doom, but not on Star Trek, you know. So that was kind of some heavy stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, Stamets is, you know, that's why my wife was saying he knows how to push his buttons, because Stamets technically volunteers for it, but he kind of got talked into it.
Yeah, he absolutely did. I think, as we said, he knows how he knows what pushes people's buttons, so.
Right, right. But, you know, also as a general in war, this is a moral question. Is what Lorca did right? We don't know if Stamets lives or dies, because at the end, everything goes kablooey. But let's say Stamets did die. But
which I was questioning this episode, believe it or not. I mean, the whole the Into the Forest thing, and when he mentions that in the kind of the stupor of the many jumps, I thought, yeah, like, oh, you know what? He's gonna go into the light, and that's gonna be it.
Yeah, I didn't know either. I don't think he's dead yet. I think that when we get to the next episode, he's going to be spazzed out in some way. But we saw Georgiou die. We saw what's her name, the first security chief, die. It's not been. We saw Snailhead get killed on the Shenzhou. So let's say he did do it, though. If he ended the Klingon War by sacrificing his own man, it's not exactly the most noble way to go, but, you know, these are trying times. War is hell, you know? It's not it's not easy to know. So, anyway, I thought it was interesting that they went that route, but, you know, we definitely got to see Lorca be the hero, and then we absolutely get to see Michael Burnham be the hero when they're on the sarcophagus ship. They find the Admiral. She can't move. Tyler gets PTSD'd out when he sees.
And I was already questioning what this was about.
Totally Vok. He's so Vok.
Yes, there's a scene later that, yes, 100%, yes.
He's the Vokiest Vok there ever Vok'd. He's 100,000% Vok.
I mean,
but Yeah, no, he flipped out, so he's down, and Michael Burnham is like, I will go. And she zooms off into battle. Now, why the hell did they have to put those two? I mean, it's a TV show, I know. But they got to put one homing beacon somewhere, like, you know, in a broom closet where it's fine. But then they have to put the other one on the bridge?
And how no one saw her is beyond
ridiculous.
Me.
Well, I mean, they did establish, granted, they were very lucky. Michael Burnham and company are very lucky in that the bridge of the sarcophagus ship is crazy. Like, had it been the bridge of any other ship anywhere in Star Trek, she would have walked onto the bridge and they'd be like, who are you? What are you doing here? Like,
no, signal masker is going to protect
them
from that.
Yeah. Well, there's that. But I mean, could you just imagine if it was the bridge of Picard's ship and like the turbo lift opens and like, you know, that nice kind of like beige hotel room looking bridge with the sleek bar of tactical displays behind her and just like this like young Klingon with a giant suitcase shows up and they're like, hello, I'm gonna place this here.
Luckily,
the sarcophagus ship looks different. And they established that since episode one. So the writers get a pass and she can hide under the thing, which is nice. Now, I did watch this episode twice because I at first didn't know what the hell they were doing. And then I realized that the reason that the Klingons didn't just leave when the Discovery is doing their spore jumps is because Burnham was on the bridge and started shooting people.
Yes.
That's why they didn't go anywhere, because the captain was occupied. Had she not done that, was that always part of the plan, or were they kind of winging it? That's what I ask you.
Well, I don't think they counted on the fact that, well, maybe that's why they left them there, because, I mean, to me, in order to save their lives, I would have, as soon as they uncloaked, I would have beamed the crew back. But they left them on there until after the jumps were complete. So maybe that was part of it, but it wasn't explicitly said.
I will say to you that the basic plan, Lorca's plan, is a little bit confusing, and I tried to map it out. So let me run this by you and tell me if you agree. Step one is they got to get on the ship. That's easy enough done. They got to show up, wave hello, and when they're uncloaked, they can beam
aboard. And before the shields go up.
Before the shields go up and have their signals masked as Klingon. Then they got to place the two things and call home. So even though they call home, the ship is already cloaked. So, and the ship has to be cloaked for them to get the vectors of every angle. That's why they were jumping around, was to take ostensibly snapshots with their sensors of every angle of the ship. Why they had to do it by jumping and not just by doing figure eights in space, I don't exactly know, but I guess they had to pinpoint certain sections,
well,
and it was...
What I took out of it was that earlier on they said how the spore drive works is it needs like some massive amount of computing power. So I figured that... So they need an organic component to it, like a brain or the tardigrade or whatever. I think that the jumps were allowing them to use that power to kind of speed up the process, because they said it would take days or hours or something like that.
Right, but how? I don't know how the jumping.
Yeah, at that point, using the spore drive and activating it, I don't know. Maybe just they were kind of running the equations through Stamets in a way, I suppose. That's how I rationalized it.
Oh,
I could totally be wrong.
Okay.
But that's good.
You know, I had a friend who was a screenwriter, and he once told me that as long as you, the writer, knows what's going on and it's kind of locked in, and you leave just enough breadcrumbs for the audience to basically follow along, it's kind of okay. Like, it's all right if the show is one step ahead of you. You just kind of have to trust. So I think your theory, there's got to be some reason, but at first it was like, yeah, we need 5 days to process it, but not if we can jump around. They didn't connect the dots for us, but I like your answer there, that somehow spore jumping means a compression of time to compute this information. But there still was the question of how did they, you know, while they're doing their jumps, and they did 133 of them, you would think that the sarcophagus ship would just be like, what the hell's going on? This ship's gone crazy. We're out of here. And zoom away. And luckily they didn't, because Burnham caused a distraction.
Yeah.
And never did Burnham say, I'm going to go on the ship and fight hand-to-hand combat with Cole.
That is true, yeah.
It seemed kind of as if that just happened spontaneously. I mean, but luckily it did, because it saved the day. But I feel like they did not have a contingency plan for that. But I guess that's why you need Specialist Burnham on board, because she's going to save the day, right?
Yeah. That's why that's right. Loker's reasoning for keeping her.
That's really exactly. So that is my note, which, you know, if our friends Ted Sullivan and our other producers of the show want to help us out with an email and explain, but I don't really need it explained. Like, it still works as a viewer, like as a Star Trek maniac who wants to sort of connect every line. I didn't quite get it, but you know what? Maybe it'll be explained in the next episode when they do a post-mortem, you know, of explain the Battle of Pavo and how it won, because they're going to have time, because they're trapped in this netherworld. But anyway, I just thought that was kind of neat. I enjoyed the whole away mission. Like I said, I was on the edge of my seat.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too, with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
This is Engage.
Engage.
The official Star Trek podcast.
Energize.
What really surprised me, what looked like the death of Cole, right? It looks like he's done.
Yes, I agree.
But it's always but. I happened to just watch. Literally,
actually, wait
the day,
a minute. No, he didn't. He didn't die. I remember her jumping away. She jumped away.
Laurel jumped into the beam. Laurel's on the Discovery.
No. But you're talking about Cole.
On the ship, the sarcophagus ship explodes. It looks like everybody.
Oh
gets
yes, I forgot the ship exploded. Oh my god!
Whoops. Well, not only did it explode, it exploded in the coolest way. Number one, Lorca puts in his eye drops because he knows it's going to be bright.
Yeah,
which is such a badass move.
It was pretty badass.
He's like, I want to watch this. I don't want to shield my eyes because I've got sensitive eyes. He puts on his eye drops so he can watch the ship explode, fire, and the photons torpedo blow it up. And then he turns around to face Burnham coming off the turbo lift, and he's walking away from the explosion. So it's like the first time
it's ever happened in Star Trek.
It's the first time it ever happened in space.
Yeah.
People walk away from explosions in, you know, Steven Seagal movies all the time. But Jason Isaacs, ladies and gentlemen, is the first person ever to walk away from an explosion in space. So by all accounts, it looks like Cole dies. And he even shouts, no, when the photon torpedoes are coming in. However, we don't see his body burn to a crisp. And as it happened, just when I watched this episode yesterday for the first time, earlier in the day, I rewatched with my nephew, who had never seen Galaxy Quest.
Okay.
Galaxy Quest, of course, an old by the great director Dean Pariseau, one of the friends of this podcast, one of our earliest guests. He'd never seen Galaxy Quest, and Galaxy Quest ends almost the same way that that the fight with Saris, the evil Vorgon or whatever he is, the Saris's ship blows up a lot like the sarcophagus ship does. And the death of Saris looks a lot like the death of Cole. And you think that Saris dies in the explosion, but then he shows up on the Galaxy Quest ship for one final battle, because you don't actually see his body explode. And just the way that the explosion looked, and the way that the Saris on the ship, and the way that Cole looked, the way it was framed. It's almost, I should do screenshots of both and put them up online, because they they do look kind of similar. And I was thinking of, hey, I just saw this on Galaxy Quest. So that makes me think that maybe Cole isn't dead, or at least Cole may be dead in that universe, but who knows what we're going to see in season 1.5. Well,
obviously in Galaxy Quest, Saris makes, you know, he makes a move very, very immediately.
Yes.
Clearly some time passed between the battle on the Discovery and when they made that extra jump. So, right. I mean, he either A, could be hiding, or B, could have transported to the planet, which was not an option for Saris at the time, because I don't think there's any planets nearby.
Right, right. So we'll see. But, you know, the point I'm making is, after the battle, again, Lorca kind of convinces, in a passive-aggressive way, Stamets to do one last jump. Now, here's my theory. All right, everybody sit down. Because we know that Lorca does not... He's not too keen on what Admiral Cornwell has to say about him. You know, it's not like he wants to kill her, but he didn't go out of his way to rescue her either. She is now off the ship, right? They said that her medical shuttle bay has reached Starbase 46. She's in surgery, and she's expected to live and make a full recovery. Now, it's time for the Discovery to make its way to Starbase 46, and they could warp there. But there are Klingons that are cloaked in the neighborhood. It's not the safest ride. And Stamets is like, oh, I'll do a jump. And Lorca's like, no, there's no need. And he's like, yes, I'll do my jump. And then he does the whole spiel about, it's my final jump. And after this, I want to be studied by doctors, and they want to learn about my this, that, and the other thing.
And
but Lorca,
not to forget also, they said they were giving Lorca a medal, and he said, no, give it to Stamets to kind of, you know, further butter his
wheels.
Yeah,
butters him up. so Stamets and Lorca are the only two people that have been discussing the fact that spore technology, spore jumping, has given them some sort of insight into parallel universes, mirror universes, if you will. So Lorca probably wants to hide for a while. He's ashamed of what he did. He knows that his number's up with Cornwall. And who knows what he wants? Who knows? He's also got his own PTSD from his battles, you know?
That's true.
That's a running theme in this show. My theory is this. The last beat of the show is they do their final black alert, and then the ship, as you see, kind of does something kooky. It makes like a double when it spins around. There's a mirror image, if you will. And then they go, where have we gone? We don't know. And there's never been something like this. They just jumped 133 times with no problem. Why would this jump be an issue? And also, why would Stamets kind of know, right? He's given the vibe that he knows something's up, you know?
Well, I mean,
it's very... You go ahead.
Clearly, this is all Lorca's doing. I mean, you see him punching some coordinates that looks like, you know, similar to where the text on the screen when they were doing the other jumps before. Yeah. I mean, he clearly hit some coordinates in that had to do with that experiment that was furthered by the jumps from earlier. So he used that data, and he put that in there so he can run away.
So you think what I think, that the big cliffhanger is not just a random
error. No, it is absolutely by Lorca's design.
Oh, okay. Here I was thinking I was going to have to convince you with my crazy
absolutely.
Theory, but you agree. Oh, okay, good. So we both agree. Because I think that that's what happened. I think that it was not just a rudimentary problem, because it would make no sense. They've been jumping all day. Stamets acts really weird, as if he knows it's going to happen. I think it's because he has insight into... You know, I don't know.
Vibe, I didn't pick up on that. He seemed completely clueless to that. I mean, said.
I was thinking. All right, that's a good. Well, I was interpreting it as he was being very fatalistic. You think that maybe he was just being romantic because he knew it was he was they were going to soon be back at the Starbase and they were going to he was going to retire.
Exactly. He was basically going to go be studied, and he was talking to Dr. Hugh and the, how they were going to go visit the moon or there's some opera there that he's going to go sit through. I mean, I don't think that he would have done that knowing that that was Lorca's intention. I mean, he's absolutely going to figure it out, be the first one to figure it out, but I don't believe he knew it doing that last jump.
Okay. All right. Open to interpretation. Yeah. I don't know. I guess I was getting a vibe. I mean, maybe I was just getting the vibe like this is all ending too happily. Something bad's got to happen. Maybe that's just what it was. But yeah. So you think so? It was not just a regular error. I love the way they showed the mirror, how it, because, you know, the first time you ever see a mirror episode in TOS was when the ship like would do flippy floppy. It was facing right then facing left and it went back and then it toggled away. This I thought was really cool, the way they visualized it. But yeah, there's somewhere else, and there's dead, there's debris. They're in a debris field. Somebody says, "Is this Klingon? Are these Klingon Klingon debris?" And they don't know.
Yeah, I was wondering if the I mean, I saw a lot of red in that debris. I was curious if you had any insight into anything with that.
Red. I know that Vulcan science ships had like a rust color. Could have been destroyed Vulcan ships, but like a brown. But I don't know. Either way, it's pretty cool. And the other thing, if Cole is dead, it is interesting how, like, yes, we've had a full arc. We've had the Klingon arc, and it ended. And now we have a next arc, you know, where, like, now it's a real... Yeah, you know, like the first part of the show is over. You know, it really feels like this is the next chapter. Now they're in Mystery Land. I think probably the Mirror Universe.
Yes.
They're in the Mirror Universe or somewhere, and that will be the next X amount of episodes is getting out of the Mirror Universe, and then we'll do the next adventure, you know? But there are some, which is great. I mean, that feels like a real show to me, you know? Like it's a real way to start the next part of the show. But there are some lingering things, which is Tyler.
Correct.
And Vok. And you were the first to float it, and I thought you were crazy. But I believe it now. Vok is a Manchurian candidate. He does not know that he has been given false memories. And, you know, that was somewhat triggered by seeing Laurel. He... you know, because the number, you know, from the beginning, the numbers never added up about how long that he was there.
Yes.
But I really do think now that he's Vok, we, you know, some people in the comments think that I'm nuts. But Brian, you knew from the get go. You knew what time it was.
Too many years of watching plot twists on Game of Thrones.
That's what it is. Yeah. You know, it's funny. Game of Thrones. Cole is Khal Drogo. You know.
Yeah.
He was the big bad guy for the first half of the first season, and now he's gone.
Yeah.
You know? That's Cole. And Kenneth Mitchell, the actor, if he never comes back, he can still be the Khal Drogo of the show and come to conventions. But, Brian, I say it again. You knew what time it was.
I did know what time it was. And you know why? I did.
Listeners of the show should know that Movement Watches is the exclusive sponsor these days of Engage, the official Star Trek podcast. And Movement Watches are sleek, handsome, beautiful, and very nicely and reasonably priced watches that were, they look like $1 million, but they cost under $100. And if you go to mvmt.com/engage, you get 15% off and free shipping. And you're going to say, what do I need with a watch? If I want to know what time it is, I can look at my phone. And I say, no, that's a loser's way to know what time it is. Your phone is in your pocket. You're wearing jeans. You're sitting down. By the time you know what time it is, you've been digging around. You know, by the time you get there, it's a different time. It takes so long. These movement watches were designed by two guys. I forget their names. Brian, you remember their names?
I don't remember their names.
Let's call them Khal and Takuvma.
Sure.
So Khal and Takuvma.
Wait a minute, but Khal and Takuvma didn't get along that well.
Yes, but they actually shared a sim. You know, it's funny. Khal and Takuvma share a very similar political theory. They are pro you know, pro-Klingonists, even if they don't see eye to eye.
True, and but you're right. They want the same goal.
Let's call them Vok and Takuvma. Right?
There we
Vok
go.
Of course, one ended up dead, and the other one is disguised as a human. But nevertheless, Vok and Takuvma were two young Klingons who were right out of college, and they had entry-level jobs at fancy places, and they wanted to look slick. They wanted to look like they impressed the boss. But they didn't have money to go to a department store and spend $500 on a stinking watch. So they started making their own. And that's what these are. These are great. They're like in disguise. They're like having a pattern simulator for your watch. You know, it's like you can be Lieutenant Tyler, even though you're really Vok on the inside. they're handsome looking. And like I say, they're about $95, but they look really sleek. Check out the designs yourself. Don't just listen to me. You go to mvmt.com/engage, and you know, you'll see how nice they look, and then you'll find out that, you know, with the shipping and everything, you're looking at under $100, maybe 100 if you get one of the end of the line ones. They're maybe 105, 110, but by and large, they're around $100, and I think you're gonna like them. So MVMT Movement Watches is the way to go. And Brian, like I said earlier, you clearly had your eye on, you had knew what time it was because you called Tyler being a Vok of a like sleeper cell, and I think that's what it is, because he's experiencing PTSD of the certainly just kind of the overall sexual abuse and torture, but there's an in the imagery, there's like a wash of imagery. And it involves a lot of, like, drills.
Yeah, he saw some saws and stuff.
Yeah, and he doesn't have scars on his
no,
face.
No, that was the biggest thing. I mean, if you're really getting tortured, I mean, there's no way they're going to leave you completely intact, like, physically like that, you know?
Yeah. I mean, you know, who knows what's going on under his shirt, but he's got a Shahzad Latif is a beautiful man, and he's a very he is a beautiful, handsome gent, and he does not look like a guy who's had drills in his face like they have in those dream sequences. So, yeah. And then of course the closest thing we have to a smoking gun is he returns to the brig, and Laurel says, I forget the exact line, but something like soon or...
She says, I'll never let anything happen to you or let them take you or something.
But then she says soon at the end. She's like, soon.
She does say soon, yeah.
You know, something like just hang out there. So it's pretty... it's pretty weird. I mean, the cover story kind of works. It could just be, if you want to take it all on face value, that Tyler was there for 7 months... And she was his torturer, even though the numbers don't add up, because she was on the sarcophagus ship floating in space, eating garbage for a while. And it could just be that she fell in love with him and has some sort of weird reverse Stockholm syndrome affection for him. That could be the case, but I don't think so, because we've seen her be very manipulative with the Admiral.
Yes.
I mean, we really don't know what her true intentions are. We suspect it is to... We suspect that she has an allegiance to Takuvma. And yes. If that is the case, then she would want to have a Vok / Tyler in there on Discovery. Now, the other thing is, the assumption that I've had up until now... Because I never bought your Manchurian Candidate theory, was that Vok would never agree to it. What I'm thinking now is that Vok didn't agree to it, and she manipulated him. She brought him to the matriarchs of Mokai and said, we're going to change your face, but don't worry. You know, we're going to give you a cover story, but it's not going to be that big of a deal. And then, you know, they put him under anesthesia or whatever. Well, no anesthesia because the face is getting torn apart. But, you know, they put him in the surgery room and she's like, ha, 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 screw you, pal. I'm going to wipe your memory and load you full of engrams like a replicant. And here you go. Could be, because who knows? Laurel is not necessarily a trustworthy person.
I don't know. I think that they in the time that Laurel and Vok spent on the sarcophagus ship, they kind of developed a relationship of sorts, and I believe that. I mean, the fact that she knows that's Vok under there is why she sought out Tyler in a sexual regard. So I mean, I think she's very very clearly knows what she's doing with everything, and I don't necessarily know if she's trying to pull one over on him, but I think that she may legitimately care about him.
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, maybe.
Could go either way. It really could go either way. I mean, I also find Lorel to be a very interesting character, too, to be perfectly honest.
Yeah, everything's wild. I mean, it's good. There's a lot of unanswered questions, which I think is really great. But I must give you credit, Brian. You all signs point to your theory being correct. And if somebody wants to go back and be a historian of this podcast, one can find somewhere in the notes, in the historical records, me saying to you, "Pish posh, Brian, you don't know what you speak of." And now it looks like I'm eating my words. It looks like you were right.
So now the real question is that how does it resolve itself? Does it resolve itself with where Vok wakes up and he's like, "Okay, yep, I'm with you, Lorel. Let's go take over the ship." Or is he going to fight it and try to stay as Tyler, based on his romance with Burnham?
Yeah. Oh, that's definitely what's going to happen. He's gonna wake up. Listen to me. That's definitely what's going to happen. But what I think will happen is when the awakening happens, and they'll probably have a Klingon name for it. You are experiencing Plachtuch. When he experiences whatever, the old memory of Vok will reemerge, but it will not subsume everything he's experienced since the transformation. So he's going to remember everything he's done. And one of the things he did was fall in love with Burnham.
Yeah.
And he's not going to want to go back. Isn't that what Dark Matter, the sci-fi show Dark Matter, is about? I haven't watched it, but I read the comic that it was based on. I read like the first X amount of issues. Have you watched Dark Matter at all?
I have not seen the show, no, but I've heard of it, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, Dark Matter is a recently canceled sci-fi show that has a bit of a cult following, and they say, unfortunately, that it just cut off right in the middle. Like, you know, it's one of those tragedies where they're like in the middle of a great arc and then it's like pulled the plug. But I read the first, let's say, three or four comics. I think it was a Dark Horse, or maybe it was... I guess it was Dark Horse Comics that did it. Maybe it was one of the other ones. What's the one that Image? Is that what it's called? Image Comics?
Image, IDW, Dark Horse. Those are the kind
it was,
of...
Yeah, it wasn't IDW, but it was either Image or Dark Horse. And it was really cool. And I don't remember it too well, but they all wake up with amnesia, and then they discover that they're bad, right? And it's like, oh,
you
shit.
You know what? I might have seen the pilot of that show, actually, now that you mentioned that.
Yeah. Anyway, I think that's the road that they'll go with this. Although maybe they won't, because that's the
right.
Cliche.
This is Dark Horse Comics.
Dark Horse Comics. Yeah. Dark Matter, Dark Horse. A lot of darkness. I think that maybe that won't be the way they're going. I mean, look back at the last episode on Pavo, where you're watching it going, oh, Saru is going to become good once the blue light bugs leave him. And you know, Burnaby says, "Saru, this is not you." And he goes, "No, it is me. Finally, I'm free." And he's not possessed. You know, they did a switcheroo, so maybe they'll do a switcheroo here.
Well,
but
I feel like I'm reminded of. I hope I'm not spoiling this for anybody, but have you ever watched Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D.?
I watched the no.
Okay, so I'm going to spoil season one a little bit here. The first season was a little rocky, but towards the end of it, once the Winter Soldier movie came out, it got pretty good, and they had a character on that show that was, you know, with the team the whole time and everything like that. And then after that flip, you find out that he was a double agent the entire time and was completely aware of it, and they committed to it, and he stayed a bad guy for the series, and I was always impressed by that. So you know, maybe they will follow suit, because you don't see that very often. You usually see them kind of have the change of heart on
most
TV shows.
Right, kind of what we're expecting. You know what would be the most badass thing for Discovery to do is to never show Vok again.
Yeah.
Is like he never gets mentioned, and Tyler is Tyler, and we've been wasting our breath this whole time, and just Tyler is Tyler.
Yeah.
And Vok is like, and then maybe a long while from now, somebody mentions Vok, and Lorel's like, "Yes, he is on the moon of Matriarch, and one of these days I got to go back there." And then, like, you cut to the matriarchs of Mokai, and like Vok is just there, like playing solitaire, just like, "Hey, hello, I'm still here. What's going on?"
Yeah, that well, would be, anyway. You know what? I'd be totally into that. I really would.
I'm going to make a note. I'm going to send an email to my friends. I'm going to send it to info@StarTrekDiscovery.cbs and send that to the producers and tell them to do that. Other little notes I had, and I like I mentioned, I watched this episode twice, and I didn't really catch it the first time. Dr. Culver is screaming about Stamets's white matter counts in his temporal lobe. What the hell kind of technobabble is that? That's fantastic.
I have
fantastic.
No idea.
What is white matter? I never heard of that. It's so cool. But like, it was the type of thing you don't even hear the first time. It's like, his white matter counts in his temporal lobe. Like, good for you. This episode was written, by the way, I met one of the two women who wrote it, Erica Leipold and Bowie Yun Kim. I met Bowie in... briefly, I met her very, very briefly in Las Vegas, but it was a very warm meeting, and she was just the bee's knees. She was just, I got, she was part of the, how do you say, the costume contest pre-judging, because in Las Vegas, they have so many awesome people that come in costumes that there needs to be a, you know, they need to reduce it down to 25 or 30 per category.
Best
or else,
the best.
You know, the best of the best. And if they didn't do that, the costume contest would last all day. So she was part of the prejudging. And at the time, Brian, as you know, I like to get dressed up myself because I moderate the costume contest. And for the past few years, I've had John Paladin, who's very well known in the con scene. He's been there for years and years and years doing special effects makeup. And so one year he made me a Klingon, and one year he made me an Andorian, and this year I was a Charon, or Bele or Lokai, which is the half black, half white face from the original series, season 3. And I was also like wearing a dopey suit. So I come out of my makeup and I wander into the kind of holding area where they're doing the prejudging. And it was Bowie and one or two other people. I forget who else it was. It might have been Terry Farrell might have been involved. But anyway, I was just watching her watch the characters, and she was like so thrilled. I think it was her first convention, and she's relatively young. And she was just overjoyed and really into the detail and knew like a lot of the deep cut stuff. I mean, some of these costumes are like, you know, I'm in season 4, episode 3 of Voyager for 2 seconds and I am a blah. And she knew a lot of it. And what she didn't know is she didn't try to fake. And she was really detail oriented and just really cool. And then, you know, so we talked for 2 minutes, but like I got to watch her interact with the fans. And, you know, at the time they didn't know who the hell she was. You know, this episode hadn't come out yet. But anyway, that's just my way of saying that I am in her corner because she seemed really cool.
Nice.
Her partner, Erica, I haven't met, so I have no opinion of her, but I'm sure she's very nice. Okay, so what is the next little note I had was, I think it was the white matter was something that was funny, and Burnham being a badass, everybody comes home, and then the drops in the eyes was, I think, my favorite part of the whole episode.
Yeah, that was, as you said, very badass.
Yeah. Yeah, so that's, I think, what it's going to be. So, you know, we've got now officially a half season done. We've got a story arc done. The Klingon War is basically over, as far as I'm concerned. They blew up the mothership. They know how to crack the code of the rudimentary cloaking device. And the Federation's probably going to break. They're probably going to, you know, blow up maybe 4 or 5 more ships, and then the Klingons will surrender. And that's that. But you know what? We're not going to see it because we're going to be trapped in Mystery Universe. And that also means who the hell knows what this next half season is going to be about.
Yeah.
I have one idea. You ready for this?
Sure.
What's to say? And this is, I have no evidence of this whatsoever. Nothing. But wouldn't it be amazing? Would it not be amazing if Michael Burnham, oh, and speaking of closing out the arc, she got Giorgio's badge back.
Yes.
Redemption
yeah.
for Giorgio.
I wanted her to walk over to Saru and hand it to him so badly, but she didn't do that yet.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't she do that?
Maybe she will in the next episode.
No, she should have done it then. Brian, make them change that. That would have been so much. That would have brought a tear to my eye.
Yes, it would have.
You're right. Well, here's my theory. We saw Giorgio's badge in this one. What about in episode 10, we see Mirror Universe Giorgio?
Oh, and that would be a great way to bring back Michelle Yeoh.
It would be great. It would be great to bring her back, and it would be super great if Burnham and Saru had to fight the evil version of their mentor.
Oh, that would be fantastic.
Yep.
I mean, the other thing I keep thinking about, too, is if, as we've mentioned, you know, there is no prior knowledge of Discovery in any other Star Trek series because they hadn't created it yet. But, you know, and we had even floated this early on in the show, is that what if they go to another universe and they don't come back? And that's why we don't know about it.
It so certainly would be rather, it would be tidy, wouldn't it?
It would be very tidy, but it's also kind of like a little bit too much like Voyager, I suppose.
Yeah, yeah, it would be. It would be. But I was thinking that, too. It's like, well, there you go. Part of it was like when they did that, the last shot had me very, I was like kind of all over the place. I'm like, first of all, I was like, they killed Cole? What the F? And they're like, Stamets is now like tripping out. He took like 1,000 doses and he's just like twitching on the floor. What's going on there? But he's not dead because I didn't want him to die. By the way, we didn't mention, finally, the Stamets and Colbert kiss.
Yes.
Which was very nice because that was a boundary that hadn't happened. And the first time you see them as partners brushing their teeth, which some argue is even more intimate, and they didn't kiss, it was like, hey, I thought they were gonna kiss, but all right, they didn't. And now they saved it and they did it nice. Yeah. When it finally happened, it felt very very real and very organic, and it was like a high pressure moment, and I was with them, and I you know, you're invested in their relationship. They work together. You felt nervous for both of them, you know.
On the same note, I agree that felt very much like a high point, but at the same time, to go back a little with the PTSD scenes with Tyler and Laurel.
Oh yeah.
I mean, that was a little more, probably the most graphic scene like that in any Star Trek. Is it fair to say that?
Yes.
And I'm pretty sure I saw some partially nude Klingon parts there as well.
It was a little risque, and it's not meant to be titillating at all either. It's very upsetting. So it is probably that scene is the most graphic in every sense of the word. You know, viewer discretion is advised, not because so much of the nudity, just sort of the upsetting nature of what's going on in that scene.
Yeah,
you know?
But I felt those two things actually very much mirrored them, you know, thematically.
Because there was something groundbreaking in a very negative way, and there was something groundbreaking in a very positive way. You know,
yes.
there was this scene of I guess rape is the word to call it. He was being raped by her.
Yeah.
And he was very upset remembering it, and then there's a moment of tenderness and care between two individuals who happen to be of the same gender, which is something that some people in our society do not accept, and they can go screw themselves. So that's right. It was kind of putting them side by side, I imagine, was no coincidence, you know.
Yeah.
That was something thematically really neat. So there's a lot going on at the end of this episode. And, you know, you have Tyler remembering this horrible thing. Also, the implication, I don't think that Tyler and Michael Burnham were intimate with one another, but they do sleep on the couch together, you know,
yes,
in their clothes. So I don't think they were physically intimate, but I think that they were, their bond has grown exponentially, you know, in a matter of time. So it's going to be, you know, they really are a pair at this point. So that's a whole thing going on. Stamets's eyes are glazed over.
Oh, and, yeah, I forgot about that.
Yeah, he's looking like a lunatic. And then they don't know where they are. And then they pull out. And I think Saru might have the last line. He goes, I do not know where we are. And then they pull out of the window and they go through the vastness of space. And part of me was like, I was in such a daze that I'm like, what the F are we going to see? And I'm like, ah, we're going to see the old Enterprise. Like, we're going to see 1966 James T. Kirk with the velour shirts. Like, I had just had, my brain was just like firing. I was like Stamets on a mycelium spore bender. I didn't know what I was going to think. And for a minute, I'm like, what are we going to see? We're going to, like, they're going to be at Deep Space Nine. There's all kinds of crazy shit's going to happen. And then it just ended. I'm like, all right, calm down, calm down, calm down. They're just in another place, and we got to wait a few weeks. But the ending really had me amped, you know, in a way.
Absolutely.
That's exciting because, you know, I'm watching this show as a borderline 10 levels removed insider. I know a little bit about what's happening, but not enough. But this was a moment where I was totally not thinking about this from a critique or, you know, a podcaster's point of view. I was just in the scene, in the moment.
In the moment and very excited, yes.
Yeah. So to that end, hats off to everybody, to Bowie Young Kim and Erica Leipold and the director whose name was... I had it written down. I don't know. John Q. Smith and whomever and all the producers and the entire cast. You did it, you know? You resurrected this property in 9 hours. We went from having nothing to getting us to this point where we are now, you know, God knows where in the timeline. And I'm in it, you know? I care about these characters, and it's a really big deal. And with all sorts of obstacles, you know, business obstacles, you're on a streaming service that nobody has, and you got to pay for it, and there's still commercials. Good luck getting people to sign up, you know? By the way, you have one of the most famous and reputable executive producers running the show, and he's going to write the first two episodes. Oh, but guess what? He's gone now, and you got to start over. Good luck, you know? Oh, and everybody's watching. Oh, and let's not forget, we're in the middle of a lawsuit with a fan film that's trying to monkey up the works, and it's very visible, and in all the trades, and in not even the trades, you know, regular news outlets like BuzzFeed, but you can't comment because you're not allowed to go on the record because it's an active lawsuit. So that entire article that my colleague Adam Vary, who I admire a great deal and did a great amount of work on, there are quotes night and day from the other side, but nobody from CBS was allowed to discuss it because they had a gag order on them. So good luck getting your show going. They overcame those obstacles, you know, much like Michael Burnham herself, Brian, who was considered the mutineer and sentenced to a lifetime in prison, and then on a shuttlecraft where the pilot was killed, and, you know, were it not for the tractor beam that saved them, still, somehow, she persevered, she found her place on the new ship, and she rose to heroic stature, saving the day, saving the Admiral, defeating the Klingons, cracking the code of the rudimentary cloaking device. That in itself is a microcosm, I say, of what the producers, writers, directors, and stars of Star Trek Discovery have accomplished in a mere 8 or 9 weeks. I say a round of applause.
Yes, absolutely. I would clap, but I'm holding a microphone, so.
Yeah, same here. Well, that's exciting. So listen, we take a few weeks off, and then we have, and then we come back. But in the interim, we got a great show lined up for next week. Can we give away who the guest is?
I say we absolutely should.
I say we should, because we don't have that many people that listen all the way to the end of the show. We recorded an episode last week with Ted Sullivan, the one of the big movers and shakers of Discovery. We had only watched up to episode 8, so we couldn't discuss episode 9. But we don't really get into the nitty-gritty of each episode. We just talk about Star Trek in general with Ted Sullivan. So that episode will air in a week's time. And then we've got some other stuff lined up. And then next thing you know, it'll be 2018. So with that, Brian, any last words on this?
Yes, I wish I would have thought of this earlier, but I wanted to mention with the whole Vok and Tyler thing is that how I read numerous articles this week about how Shahzad Latif and I think even Jason Isaacs were dodging questions about have you ever met Javad Iqbal? It was fun.
Good for them. Yeah. Good for them. Yeah. Well, who knows? Who knows? Who knows? We'll know eventually, but who knows for now? All right. So you know what? I think it's time to wrap it up because for more reasons than you can imagine, including the fact that I really got to take a pee. So, Brian, I want to say thank you once again, and thank you for mixing and making sure the levels are nice. And listeners, thank you for being there. We did it 9 episodes of recaps in a row. With by and large, we got them to you without much hassle. Oh, if we could tell you the behind the scenes stories. But we got them to you, and now we're excited to take a few weeks off and then dive back in. So until then, live long and prosper.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.